What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome into another episode of the Tables, Tailgates, and Top Loaders podcast. I am your host, TB, aka Tim Beardsley, and this is episode 8. So thank you all so very much for stopping in and checking out the 3 T's. So much to get to today. So much wrestling to talk about over the weekend. Don't want to waste any time. I want to dive right in and start with the Bills fans. Mafia members, you are on the clock. How are we feeling? I want to get to you and the top loaders portions first before we do a deep dive into the world of professional wrestling. But Bills fans, James Cook, have you seen that he cracked the top 100 of the top NFL players moving into the 2025 season? He came in at number 89, and this is his first trip on the list. So how does this affect his contract negotiations? We shall see what happens. But number 89, how are we feeling about that? Last year, if you remember the 2024 top 100 list, the Bills only had two players crack the top 100. They had Deion Dawkins, obviously left tackle extraordinaire, guarding JA17, guarding his left side there. He came in all the way at number 96. And then Josh Allen made his entry into the list all the way up at number 12. I think JA is going to be much higher. He should be at least in the top 5, if not top 3. Deion is going to be on there. And then obviously James Cook cracked the list at 89. But who else we think is going to make this list? I think we have a shot at probably 5 players. Obviously, you have James Cook, Josh Allen, Deion Dawkins. Maybe Spencer Brown makes the list. He had a hell of a year coming in there at the right tackle position. And then maybe we see Christian Benford crack the top 100. I think the Bills have a legit shot of getting at least 5 players on the list, which when all is said and done, will look pretty good. So how does this affect James Cook's contract negotiations? If I were a betting man, I would say that the minute he came out at number 89, his agent probably sent the article or the drop to Brandon Bean and said, yeah, you really need to re-sign this guy. Now, if you all follow the news, an article came out just under a week ago, and this article is in the USA Today saying that now suddenly there's growing optimism that James Cook and the Bills can reach a contract agreement before the start of training camp, which would be crazy. So if you remember a few episodes back, we talk about this James Cook saga and how he was disconnected with the team and the city and all this stuff. And now there is a article that came out, obviously someone speaking on condition of, you know, secrecy and anonymity, or however the hell you say that word. But a person allegedly familiar with the situation told USA Today that both sides are motivated to get a deal done and that they have been in talks since he showed up at mandatory minicamp. I said as soon as he showed up to minicamp that he's not going to be holding out to training camp. That just doesn't make any sense. Training camp is getting ready to start here in just over another week, July 22nd. And he didn't skip minicamp because he basically said, I don't want to get fined because I like my money too much. Now we have this article coming out saying that they're in negotiation and it wouldn't surprise me. So where do we want to see that contract land? He was asking for 15. We talked about that before. I said 15 is an absolute ridiculous number and there's no way that anyone should be paying James Cook $15 million because only 3 running backs in the whole league are making that much money. And he's not the bell cow. He is not the guy that's going to be playing 90 to 95% of the snaps. He is part of a committee, whether we like that or not. I'm not saying he's not good, but the other guys on the team, Ray Davis, Ty Johnson, they have roles. They have very specific roles and they do different things. James Cook is not the guy you want in there to pass block for Josh Allen. He's just not. He's not. That's not the type of player he is. He is an electric, awesome player to have on the field, and he's probably one of the 2 to 3 players that at any time could take it the distance and score a touchdown. But he's not the guy that you want. You know, if the defense is throwing an all-out blitz at Allen, he's not the one you want back there protecting him. So where would we be comfortable with this contract landing? Maybe 10, 11 million. I think I'd be okay with that. Is he going to be okay with that? Now that he's cracked the top 100 NFL list at 89, is this giving him more ammunition for that fire? I don't think it's going to bother Brandon Bean one bit. I am encouraged that they are actually talking. I would like to see a deal get done. But at the end of the day, I don't want the Bills to spend crazy money on a long-term running back investment. I just don't think it's a smart way to run your football team, but we shall see. The way they are slow rolling this top 100 list this year, they put out a couple players here and there, and we're going to work our way all the way to the top, but it should be interesting to see where Allen comes in. I would hope that after an MVP season, and he just keeps getting better and better, I would hope that number one, he makes the top five at least, and number two, he is not on that most overrated player in the NFL award list this year, because that was an absolute joke. I love how he took that, used it as fuel, and then basically laughed in everyone's face all the way to the MVP. But anyway, so speaking of Josh Allen, I don't know if you all saw this. The news came out a few days ago that he has listed his California home. He has put it on the market after getting married to Haley Steinfeld. And we're going to dive right into the If Money Were No Object buy of the week, because here's what we're doing. I saved everyone a ton of money the last couple episodes. I bought some low-end hobby boxes. I think last week I bought the Upper Deck Scooby-Doo hobby box for the low, low price of, like, I don't remember what it was, $125. Well, that's because I was saving it all for this. $8.5 million. Josh Allen's California home has just hit the market, and he originally bought it for $7.2 million. Obviously, he might have made some improvements here and there, but now that sucker is all the way up to $8.5 million. It's in a lovely gated community at a private beach club, and it's crazy. So this house, what I didn't know, because I looked into it, because that's my job here, it's listed it as being in a city called Dana Point, California. Now, I had no idea where Dana Point, California was, so I pulled out the old Google Maps, and what did I find? I was actually less than 15 minutes from Josh Allen's house in November of 2024. My wife actually works for a company whose headquarters is in Aliso Viejo, California. And so I had the opportunity to fly out there with her last year. And lo and behold, I had no idea that I could have met Josh Allen for a beer. I could have practically walked to his house because he was only 15 minutes down the street. And now this house at a lovely $8.5 million is up for sale. So what do we think? It is a four-bedroom, three-bathroom house, relatively modest, 2,800 square feet. So for, you know, a superstar quarterback, that's not a very big house. Not a very big house at all. I actually pulled up the listing for this, and I was looking through it. It's on a, I love how the way they tell you what the acreage of the house is. It's listed on 0.2732, so just over a quarter acre, but they call it private acres exterior space, because that's what these crazy real estate agents in California have to call lot size out there, because no one has any land. These houses are literally on top of each other. Well, this house was built in 1962. It's a single family home. It's one story. And some of the amenities, you have a, obviously there's a HOA fee associated with this craziness, but you get pickleball and tennis courts and all kinds of amenities to go in this nice gated community. As I said, it's a four bedroom, three bath house. I was expecting to be kind of blown away if this house is being listed for freaking $8.5 million. And it's fine. It's fine. It's nothing that I'm going to go absolutely crazy over. But yeah, so $8.5 million, Dana Point, California. I think I'm going to have to go, If Money Were No Object, buy the week and buy Josh Allen's house, because as a Bills fan, what cooler merch could you buy than your star quarterback's multi-million dollar California home? Not too much else going on in the Bills world as they are ramping up. Like I said last week, this is a slow time for football. Training camp is about to get underway in just over a week and a half. And we shall see. We're going to do probably a deep dive into the schedule and really look at things and start breaking down the team and positions and what we're worried about moving forward in future episodes. But I thought I would just hit you with the James Cook story and the Josh Allen's house being up for sale and see who else wants to go in with me. Maybe we can get a GoFundMe or pull together some Bills Mafia funds and make this purchase. So, trading card enthusiasts, sports cards enthusiasts, how are we feeling? Lots of stuff going on in the world of sports cards. I did see a couple articles that I wanted to talk about. There was a small card shop in Massachusetts called First Edition Collectibles, And what happened to this shop, unfortunately, last Tuesday, it got broken into. And in under 30 seconds, some clown stole a bunch of Pokemon cards valued at roughly $115,000. So he came in, smashed through the door, opened some cases, and took a bunch of stuff in under 30 seconds and came out with a whole bunch of high-end Pokemon cards from this small shop about, I don't know, an hour or so outside of Boston, maybe a little less than that. But it's crazy when this stuff happens. You know, you got a local mom and pop that are just trying to make a living. And he came out and said that he believes it was premeditated. He thinks that this guy knew exactly what he was going for because he was in and out in about 30 seconds. And he believes that the person responsible also knew the building well because they cut the lock off the gate and got in through the back door with no direct street access. So they think they know, or they think they believe that this person had been in the store. So now they're going back and watching an old video and trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. But this store's only been open a couple years, and now this clown has, hopefully they had insurance. But yeah, it was a pretty good list of cards. I think what they said was about 5 to 7 rare Pokemon cards. Most of them are graded, if not all of them, and he took a few vintage boxes. So 5 to 7 cards in a few boxes, and it's totaling almost $115,000. That's crazy. Absolute crazy. I know one was a BGS 8.5 Crystal Charizard and some other high-end Pokemon stuff. So I don't know a ton about Pokemon, but for him to steal 5 to 7 cards and some vintage boxes and it be worth that much money, we're talking crazy stuff. He said one of them is considered, quote, the crown jewel of the entire Pokemon collection, the first edition-based set Charizard. So hopefully they could track this clown down. These are pretty rare cards, so if they're trying to move them, I mean, that's the thing. You steal like high-end trading cards, you steal stuff like that with, you know, that's serialized or that there's not very many of in the world, sooner or later you're going to get caught because there's really not too many places that you can move this stuff without somebody asking questions. So hopefully trading card community, we could come together, help this shop out. You hate to see it. People are out there working hard and they just want to make a living. And this is kind of the kind of nonsense. So what else is going on? One of the things I saw coming up for sale here shortly, 2025 Topps Archive Signature Series. So here's what this is. It's one box and each box contains one card. Now you're probably thinking, well, one card, what the heck? This one card is an encased buyback autographed card. So what does that mean? Topps goes out, they buy back all these cards. Where they get them from, who knows? Secondary market, I have no idea. Maybe they're pulling product off the shelf and they are opening it. And then they take these cards from various random sets across their Topps catalog. So Bowman, Stadium Club, what have you. They have the player sign the card. It's then serialized. It's numbered. Every card is numbered less than 99. So 99 or under. It is then sealed and put in a case. And it's also stamped with a gold foil logo saying that this product is now part of this signature archive series. So this year the stamp is going to say Topps Archive Signature Certified Autograph 2025, and then they put a number on it. There's no checklist per se, but what they do tell you is the players who are autographing for the product. And this year for 2025, there are 128 players. Now, the price of this box for one card, one auto, numbered 99 or less, the price is at the time pre-sale was $79.99. And they have sold out. So I don't know where they're going to land on the secondary market. I think I saw David Adams had them for $125 or $130, somewhere around there. So a bit of a markup there. But I'm looking through the autograph signers list. Again, 128 players. And there are some good players. So you got Bobby Witt, Aaron Judge, you know, players like that, your high-end guys. But then you get some pretty crappy low-end players that you're like, ugh, if I paid $80 for a Gio Urshela autograph or a Harrison Bader, and, you know, I'm not, like, let's just look at this and call it for what it is. A Jonah Heim autograph. Do I want to pay $80 for, or $130, $125 for a Jonah Heim autograph? Lane Thomas. Now, Lane Train, back in the day, he was fast, right? But he's been trash since the last, I don't know, two and a half years. I would be disappointed if I spent $100 on a Lane Thomas autograph. Nate Evaldi, he's all right. Nathaniel Lowe, anyone? Anyone want a Nathaniel Lowe autograph? How about a Oswald Peraza autograph. Patrick Bailey, anyone? I mean, I'm going through the list. Now, you hit a PCA, a Pete Crow Armstrong, or a Pete Alonso, or a Paul Skeens. Oh, heck yeah, you're making bank. But, you know, if you're pulling a Sal Frelick or a Sean Murphy auto, yikes. So, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about this. I have purchased these cards off eBay. One of the players IPC is Royce Lewis from the Minnesota Twins, but I did purchase a 2023 Topps Archive Signature Series Royce Lewis card. This was a Bowman card of his from the 2019 set. So you had a 2019 Bowman, it's signed, and it was serialized 34 out of 99. And I think I paid under $20 for this card. So, and again, it comes in a magnet case, and Topps puts a seal over the top of it. So pretty cool. It's on card. It looks nice. But yeah, maybe wait. And you could find these on the secondary market for pretty decent. Now, obviously, you're not going to get your high-end guys for less than retail. You know, if you're chasing specific players that aren't the top of the top, you're not trying to get PCA, Paul Skeens, what have you, I think you could do well waiting. But, you know, if you can find them for 80 and you're feeling a little lucky, sure, roll the dice. So what else we want to talk about in the card market? I did see another product coming up that piqued my interest, and this is going to tie right into our huge wrestling weekend. So what is this product? It's 2025 Upper Deck AEW SP Game Used Wrestling Hobby Box. Now, these look pretty cool. They are pre-order right now, and Dave and Adams has them for around $120. Now, what this is, it's a first edition 100 card base set, including the most popular veterans and 20 rookies and et cetera, et cetera. This set is absolutely loaded with different memorabilia, and it's pretty wild. So you have authentic fabrics, which are t-shirts, things like that from different wrestlers that are worn in actual matches. You have different autos that are attached to some of these fabrics as well. You have ring blends, which are pieces of mats. So these are all very specific wrestling match used, whether it's an outfit, whether it's a piece of the ring. There's actual turnbuckles that they have in here. There's pieces of different weapons. It's kind of crazy. They use chair covers. They use different ladders. They have all kinds of stuff that I've never seen before in a product. They have a specific thing called a no DQ relic, and it's very low end numbered. I think they're numbered to 10, and they could be from a table, a trash can, a kendo stick, and they even advertise a coffin. So I'm not sure what that is, but hey, that sounds pretty freaking cool. So yeah, this set looks pretty awesome. You're not getting a ton of cards in the set. You're guaranteed one autograph, two memorabilia or tech cards per box, three base cards or authentic rookies, and then one red or gold base set authentic rookie per box. So in total, you're looking at seven cards, roughly 120, but I think some of the things on here are pretty freaking cool. All right, well, that is enough of that. Now we have to get to the main event, because now we have to talk about all the crazy wrestling that happened over the weekend. And there was so much wrestling. It was absolutely insane. And here's the thing. The great thing about wrestling is that there should always be something for everybody, right? It's almost like a buffet. You go to a buffet, maybe some people like the salad bar, maybe some people like the desserts, maybe some people like the meat carving station. There's something for everybody, no matter what type of food you like at a buffet. With this much wrestling packed into one weekend, there should be something for everybody. And I will tell you, some of it I loved, and some of it just wasn't for me. And that's okay, because that's the great thing about wrestling. You should be able to find something you love, something that you can walk away and go, hey, that was pretty damn cool. So where do we want to start? Let's start by what I didn't watch. I did not watch NXT Great American Bash. I'm sorry. You can come at me if you want. You know, at the end of the day, you got to make some choices. And I knew All In was going to take up a ton of my time on Saturday. And it did, probably too much of my time, but that's okay. And I knew something had to be sacrificed. So I'm sorry, wrestling fans. I'm sorry, wrestling marks. I couldn't watch NXT. I heard it was pretty good, but I'm not going to talk about it because I really don't know what happened. I read the results and we'll go from there. But let's start with All In Texas. I believe this is the first time they did this outside of England. So obviously it took place in Arlington, Texas, Globe Life Field. I'll be the first to tell you, when I saw the opening shots, the stage looked awesome. It looked great. And the place was packed. So well done, AEW. The pay-per-view started. It looked great. The stage looked great. The ring looked great. It looked badass. I was super, super excited to see. Now, they did the pre-show stuff. The pre-show started at 1. If you do quick calculations of when this thing ended, which was probably around, 9 o'clock, I did have to pause it at some point to, take care of things around the house and whatnot. But you're talking 8 hours of programming, which is way too much time. I didn't watch the pre-show matches. There were three matches prior to the 3 o'clock pay-per-view actually starting. I didn't watch them. But let's start with the Trios Championship, which is the first match on the actual main card. You had the Death Riders against the Ops. It was an okay match. It was fine. Samoa Joe hits his finisher on Yuta for the win. And then post-match, he gets his head put in a chair and he gets taken out on a stretcher. It was fine. I thought it was probably not the best match to start your show with, but it was fine. Then from there, we go to the men's casino gauntlet match. Now, here's the thing. When you're doing something like this, and you already know that the winner of the match is going to get a title shot, it eliminates 90 to 95% of your entrants. Because based on the people that came out to the ring, who you have no idea who these participants are going to be, but you knew, hey, it's only a handful of guys that can actually win this thing. And I think that was the problem with this match. Ultimately, it comes down to MJF. Mark Briscoe was in there for a while, and they had kind of a feud going into this match. It was kind of predictable. It was fine. And the entrances, they were all over the place. So that was the problem with this match, in my opinion. You had the spacing of the participants was just totally random. Sometimes it was 30 seconds, sometimes it was 2 minutes, sometimes it was 5 minutes. It really made no sense, but the match was fine. It was whatever. There were too many jobbers in there, too many fillers, and MJF won. Great, fine, whatever. He's the right winner. Let's move on. Then from there, you go to Adam Cole. Coming down to the ring, you learned earlier that the match between him and Kyle Fletcher wasn't going to take place and that he actually had to relinquish his TNT title. And so he's able to come out to the ring in street clothes, and he basically gives, while he doesn't come out and say it's his retirement speech, he gets pretty emotional, and it kind of seems like it could be his retirement speech, which kind of sucks because Adam Cole's pretty good. So he gives up the belt. He says he's not medically cleared, and everybody, you hope for the best for Adam Cole. Obviously, O'Reilly, Roderick Strong come out, and they're all hugging in the ring. They're all crying. So, something's really not good. But then we have this Fatal 4-Way match, and it's for the TNT title. And I got to tell you, Dustin Rhodes winning this thing. So you had Daniel Garcia, Sammy Guevara, Dustin Rhodes, Kyle Fletcher. Everyone was assuming Kyle Fletcher's going to win this, and then the match was just, I don't know. It was all right. It was fine. But then Dustin Rhodes wins, and I guess they were going for this whole Texas hometown nostalgia thing, but it was whatever. I feel like he gets the 1-2-3, and everyone's kind of looking around like, is that really supposed to happen? Was he supposed to win this? And then all these people come out and celebrate, and I'm like, dude, this is the third match of the night, and we're going crazy over Dustin Rhodes winning a TNT title. I'm like, okay. And at this point, I check my watch when this match is over, and we're almost at 5 o'clock. We're almost 2 hours into this pay-per-view, and I feel like nothing of significance has happened yet. So AEW has a significant problem with pacing these pay-per-views out. I watched the last one. The last pay-per-view was Double or Nothing, and I talked about it before on here that pay-per-view was awesome, but it was still too long, but that pay-per-view was awesome. The matches were really good. They probably could have cut a couple matches, but it was good stuff. Here, you're 2 hours in, and I feel like the show hasn't even started yet. Anyway, it's almost 5 o'clock, and we finally get, in my opinion, the start of the pay-per-view. So here we have Will Ospreay, Swerve Strickland versus the Young Bucks. Now, Ospreay's entrance, kind of cool. He comes out with this Assassin's Creed thing going on. There's samurai. They're jumping around. There's lots of pyro. It's pretty cool. Swerve Strickland's next. JoJo Offerman, if you know one of my favorite, Bray Wyatt. This is his his wife, his girlfriend, whatever. I'm not sure if they were married, but it doesn't matter. She comes out and she starts singing, and she sings essentially Swerve Strickland to the ring. Pretty cool. And then the Young Bucks come out, and in pure bad guy fashion, they are in a boat, and this boat is slowly making its way down various parts of the arena, and the announcer is giving this long, drawn-out speech, basically pissing everybody off about how great the Young Bucks are. So it was pretty funny. Clearly, they're doing it to annoy everyone, which is exactly what their job is. It was really cool. Anyway, this match gets going, and this match is a banger. Now, I've seen a lot of negativity about this match online because people were saying that there's this one section of the match where the four of them are literally, it's like watching a video game. I don't know how they did this sequence, but it's back and forth. It's move after move. And people are bitching because they're saying that the guys in the match, all four of them, are essentially no-selling each other's moves. Yes, you could look at it that way, that for this 30, 45 second stretch of the match, they are no selling. However, you could also look at it as, holy cow, the things that these guys are doing in such rapid sequence is absolutely freaking amazing. And maybe we should just watch it and enjoy it instead of complaining about everything. But I thought this was one of the best matches of the night. Crazy sequence. The crowd at this point of the 2-hour program had, maybe they had been there since one, so now we're at the 4-hour section of the program, but they finally start to wake up. The match gets going, and it's just the last 10 minutes of this thing are just pure fire. It was a banger. Great match. You have the combo move, the combo finisher. Swerve and Ospreay do their house call slash hidden blade finishers at the same time, and they get the win, and the Young Bucks lose their EVP title. So, well done. That was an awesome match. Well done. Next, we move on to the women's gauntlet match. This match was actually way better than the men's gauntlet match, and you had Athena winning. There were some good spots in this match, but I think they made the right call. Hopefully, she'll get some more TV time and make a run at the women's champ, who we're going to talk about here in a minute. But yeah, women's gauntlet match, in my opinion, it was much better than the men's. Then we get the triple threat tag team match. You had the Hurt Syndicate, Jet Speed, one of the worst names ever. Then you had Christian Cage and Nick Wade. This match was fine. It was fine. I don't know whether I was getting tired at this point or whatever the case may be, but it was a good match. It was just fine. It wasn't great. I really liked the Hurt Syndicate, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like I've seen this over and over again. Anyway, the match is over, and lo and behold, Wade turns on Christian Cage post-match, and you hear the greatest theme song in wrestling from Altered Bridge, which is Edge's music, a.k.a. Adam Copeland, a.k.a. Cope. I hate that freaking name, but here comes Adam Copeland, whatever the hell you want to call him. He makes his triumphant return. Obviously, he was put on the shelf a few months back by FTR, and now here he is to save the day. But he did the thing. He did the thing that Penta did a couple weeks ago that really ticked me off. His music hits, and then he's at the top of the ramp, and instead of running down to make the save, he's doing his dance off, and he's doing his poses, and he's playing to the crowd. And I'm like, this makes no sense. If you're supposed to be a good guy and supposed to be here helping your buddy, what are you doing playing to the crowd? You're supposed to be getting your ass to the ring and making a save. But anyway, he comes down, he makes the save, and then he turns to Christian and he tells him to go find himself, which who knows what the hell that means. I don't know. They're probably going to rejoin again. And if this brings back the 3-second pose, then I'm all for it. And then we got to talk about, in my opinion, the best match on the whole card. This was the Women's World Championship between Timeless Toni Storm and Mercedes Moné. And this is the first time we see Mercedes come out, and she doesn't have all the thousands of belts draped around her. And their entrances are cool. Moné comes out with the cheerleaders, and then Timeless Toni Storm does this black and white vignette in which she's acting like this real old lady. Then her entrance starts, and she kind of hobbles out with a cane, and it's all in black and white, and she chucks the cane and loses the robe, and it's really cool. It's really well done with the color scheme, the black and white. There's splashes of red, and it matches her outfit and her, I guess, makeup to a T. And it looks really cool. Really cool. Anyway, this match was awesome. This match was freaking awesome. I can't say enough good things about this. And then she hits 3 different Storm Zeros on Mercedes Moné. It was kind of scary. And then the match ends with a Avalanche Storm Zero from the top rope or the second rope or whatever, I can't remember. And I thought Mercedes was dead. So it was a crazy sick spot, but these two went at it. They told a great story. It was awesome. There was a lot of back and forth. Two of the best wrestlers on the planet. They put on a show and it was awesome. And one thing that I couldn't help but think about as I'm watching this match is Tony Storm's great, but I wish there was a way we could get some of these crossover events where AEW would agree to have matches against certain WWE wrestlers, because I would freaking love to see Timeless Tony Storm against Becky Lynch, the Man. I think that would be fire. Some of the promos they could do, some of the in-ring segments leading up to a banger of a match, I think that would be awesome. I want to see that match. Anyway, great job. That match was awesome. And then we get to Omega versus Okada. Now, look, I've seen most of their matches. I know that there's a ton of history there. I was looking forward to this match probably more than most of the matches on the card. I was super excited about this match, and the crowd is getting jacked. The entrances are awesome. It was a good match, but I don't know, guys. I was kind of like, I don't know. I feel like it just went on too long. I feel like it was Rainmaker after V-Trigger, one after the other, just different variations of the same move over and over again, and kick out, blah, 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 blah. And I'm just like, okay, I don't know. I feel like I couldn't get into this match for some reason. I don't know what it was about it. Maybe I need to go back and watch it again. Maybe it was because they kept talking about the stupid diverticulitis nonsense over and over and over again. And I'm just like, is this the only thing that we're ever going to talk about now? Every time Kenny Omega gets into a wrestling match, anytime he's in the ring, this is all we want to talk about, is his stupid diverticulitis. Like, I don't care. I just want to see these guys beat the hell out of each other and have a good match. Can we not make this the focal point for 35, 40 minutes? Maybe it's just me. I get it. Every match tells a different story. I'm just sick and tired of hearing that story. But anyway, they did bring Jim Ross out to join the announce team, which was nice. It's nice to see JR back in the table. That was great. And then finally, we have the main event. This is the match that we've been waiting for seems like forever. We have Hangman Adam Page versus Jon Moxley, Texas Death Match for the title. And I'll be honest with you. So Hangman, his entrance, they had a guitar player and a professional whistler. Is that right? So this lady starts whistling his theme. And all I can picture in my head as he's coming out was the Muppet movie, where if you remember this movie, there's a scene where the main Muppet, Walter, not to be confused with Gunther, but Walter the Muppet, and they're trying to save the Muppet Theater. He finally gets his big shot to perform, and he whistles as his performance. And that's all I could think about as Hangman is being whistled to the ring. But anyway, I digress. So within 2 minutes of the match starting, we visibly see Hangman take a fork to Moxley's head, and it's like you're watching one man practically stab another man in the head because the cuts are opening up and the blood is flowing, and it's like I said earlier at the beginning, like it's a buffet, right? And there's something for everybody. The beginning of this match was maybe not for me, you know. I get it. There's different stuff for everybody, but yeah, they beat the absolute hell out of each other. There were forks, there were broken glasses, there were chair spots all over the place. There was barbed wire and tables, violence galore, and it was pretty good. And then at the end, we get even more schmoz fest with all these people. We had the return of Bryan Danielson. We had the return of the Mountain Man, Darby Allin, who had probably one of the most slow descents into the stadium. It was so weird. They do this voiceover of him showing him on the mountains when he was doing his mountain climbing nonsense. And then all of a sudden you see the camera and he's suspended from the top of the arena and he's slowly rappelling down into the ring. And I gotta tell you, he didn't really look that great. So I don't know whether Darby has not been hitting the gym or what the case may be, but hopefully, maybe it was the camera angles. I don't know. It just seemed weird to me, but needless to say, a lot of craziness happening. It was pretty wild. And then Hangman literally hangs Moxley with this big chain that's thrown to him by Swerve Strickland, and all is right in the world. Mox taps out, and then you have a new champion. He opens the briefcase, and the heavens open. The angels are singing. Page finally gets his belt. All is right in the world. End of show. So, all in all, I thought it was a pretty good pay-per-view. However, way too long. Way too long. I mean, we're going on nearly 6 hours of the main show. Like I said, had the pay-per-view started at 5 and had gone 4 hours, if it had started with the Swerve Ospreay Young Bucks match and gone from there, it would have been a perfect pay-per-view. The first three matches were not good. They were just kind of whatever, and they took way too damn long. And so I think it just drug the whole thing down. But, and like I said, I had to pause it and kind of come back during the day because there was just too much going on. But anyway, by the time it was over, it allowed me to roll right into Saturday night's main event, which I'm not too sure I was glad to watch because that was kind of a crap show. Again, something for everybody. Saturday night's main event was not for me at all. The whole Jelly Roll, Randy Orton thing, what are we doing? Now we have set up a SummerSlam match where Jelly Roll is Randy Orton's tag team partner. Are you kidding me? Randy, you're better off going to the ring by yourself because what are we doing with Jelly Roll? Jelly Roll is freaking everywhere. I can't stand when they do this. I know why they do this, and it's not lost on me that this is how WWF, way back in the day, got a lot of traction by crossing genres and bringing huge superstars from entertainment and music into the mix. I get it. Look, I'm not naive enough to know why they're doing this. It just, it wasn't for me. Jelly Roll is not one of my favorites. I don't need to see him on my television every week. The best part of this was him getting claymored by Drew McIntyre. That part was awesome. So I'm hoping that at SummerSlam, Randy Orton turns bad and we see him RKO Jelly Roll. That would be fantastic. Can't wait to see that. They're already calling this RK Roll, which is terrible. I hope he RK rolls his head off and it goes down MetLife Stadium steps. I don't know. Something crazy, but I don't want to see Jelly Roll. But it is what it is. They had Solo Sikoa versus Jimmy Uso. That match was fine. But of course, you had all the bloodline there. And X-Pac Diesel, a.k.a. Tala Tonga. And it's just ridiculous. Anyway, Jacob Fatu comes down and there's a big square off and everyone's fighting everybody. And yeah, I mean, we're going to draw the battle lines here soon. So we're going to have one team, old school, new school of the bloodlines. Here we go again. It's exactly what I thought it was. And then LA Knight versus Seth Rollins. And this sucks because it appears Rollins is legit hurt. There's a spot where he does some springboards off the second rope and he tweaks his knee. And all reports are that he's going to be out for quite some time. So I'm not sure what the finish of that match was supposed to be, but Knight ends up hitting him with his finisher, and yeah, that's it. And it was weird, it was short, but it looks like it was a legit injury, and we shall see where they go from here, especially with Seth having the briefcase, the Money in the Bank briefcase. I really hope he's able to come back in time to cash in, but we shall see. And then finally we have the Goldberg of it all. Now, they had been showing promo package after promo package, video after video throughout this whole show, and it was just too much. And then the match starts. Obviously, they do the long Goldberg intro, his entrance. He's brought all sorts of people back from his career. They're in his entourage, and his son now is grown. Obviously, if you've listened to the Goldberg podcast, you know all about his son, Gage, because I've talked about him at length, and we know the history there, but whatever. Like, this was not for me at all. They did you no favors, because just when the match was trying to get good, and there's the spot outside where Goldberg misses Gunther with the spear, and he goes through the barricade, it cuts to a five freaking minute commercial, and the next thing you know, you're back in the ring, and they're in a ring, and Gunther's got him in some hold. I'm like, what just happened? I thought I missed something in the broadcast. I thought because I had pause and come back to it. I thought I missed a big portion, but no, it was just a 5-minute commercial break in the middle of your main event where you have no idea how they transitioned from outside of the ring to back in the ring, but it was freaking stupid and made absolutely no sense. But anyway, the match ends, and this is where you start to wonder, was this really supposed to be the ending with the whole Seth Rollins injury thing? But Goldberg, he gets choked out in the middle of the ring, and that's it. People are saying, oh, this was his greatest match in some time. Well, okay, fantastic. Congratulations. And here's the funny thing. Then after the match, he's in the ring and Michael Cole does the, oh, tell us about what you're feeling, blah, 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 blah. And they hand Goldberg the microphone. He literally talks for 25 seconds and the camera feed goes. And so the show's over and he's... You see the footage, the fan footage from videos that people have taken, and he's talking for like 6 minutes. You spend your whole show talking about how this is Goldberg's last match. He has his match. He loses. He's trying to give his retirement speech, and you cut the footage. You cut the feed. I'm like, what are you doing? Come on, get it together. Oh, man, that was crazy. Saturday night's main event, it sucked. That one, definitely not for me. Which brings us to Sunday, Women's Evolution. Ladies, you crushed it. You crushed it. This pay-per-view from top to bottom was awesome. Far exceeded my expectations. I'll be the first to tell you that this was the best show of the weekend. From top to bottom, this was by far the best show of the weekend. It started out with an absolute banger. Triple threat IC title match. Bayley versus Lyra. Valkyria versus Becky Lynch, the man. These three absolutely set the stage for a freaking fantastic night of wrestling. They basically came out. They said, yeah, we know there's a ton of wrestling over the weekend, but we're going to start the show. We're going to start it on fire. And they basically said, top this. It was so much fun. All three of them are great. Lyra keeps getting better and better every time she's in the ring. The ending to this match was awesome. If you haven't seen it, Bayley hits the rose plant on Lyra. She goes for the pin. And then Becky does this thing I've never seen before. It's like this matrix spin where she's rolling over, grabbing Bayley, flipping her onto her shoulders for the pin. And it's 1, 2, 3. It's just awesome stuff. Awesome, awesome match. And again, just like the Toni Storm Mercedes match, I'm watching this match wishing that I could see Becky Lynch versus Toni Storm, because I think that match would be fire. Second match, JC Jane versus Jordynne Grace. Before the match, you have Blake Monroe agreeing to be in her corner. I don't know a ton about the NXT, the roster, but the whole purpose of this match seemed to be a mechanism for Blake Monroe to turn heel, to do a real quick turn. I know she was Mariah May over at AEW. She recently came over. She went to the Performance Center, NXT, blah, 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 blah. And now she's thrust into this storyline and she's instantly a heel, which I think is a good thing for her. This match was fine. It was pretty good. I think Jordynne Grace is pretty good. I'm not sold on JC Jane as your champ. I think she's all right. But I think what they're trying to do is make her like the weak heel champion, and who knows what's going to happen. But yeah, pretty good. Fatal 4-way tag match. This was pretty awesome. This was great. Lots of action. The first 5 minutes, obviously you have Roxanne Perez, Raquel Rodriguez against Kabuki Warriors. Then you have the team of Zarya and Sol Ruka from NXT, and then Charlotte Flair and Alexa Bliss in a crazy mix of superstars that they put together. First 5 minutes, it comes out pretty good. And then Flair gets the hot tag and the place goes nuts. And I think this is what everyone was clamoring for. We don't want to see Flair automatically be handed the women's title. We don't want to see her in championship match after championship match. We want to see her do something different. And this is the perfect pairing. Put her with Alexa Bliss, who everyone loves, who's great. And I think these two can be a lot of fun. It can be great. And so this match was fast paced, lots of good stuff going on. At one point, Flair saves Bliss from a spear. Zarya ends up spearing Sol Ruka. Now, if you don't know Sol Ruka, now I don't know everybody, but if you can pull up YouTube videos of the Soul Snatcher, this is one of the craziest moves, craziest finishers you will see. She does this finisher on Charlotte Flair in this match, and it's just awesome. It's awesome. It's a crazy, crazy finisher. I don't know how she doesn't land on her head half the time, but it's pretty great. And then finally, what have I been saying about Raquel Rodriguez? You got to make her look good. She never wins. Well, thank God they listened, because I'm sure they follow the 3T's podcast. She got in a ton of power moves during this match. She seemed like a dominant heel, and they actually won the match. So the ending was a little weird. It seemed to come real quick. I'm not sure what that was about, but I think the right team won. I think her and Roxy are going to have some good stuff. And then obviously you bring Liv Morgan back into the mix, and it's good stuff. And from there, you have my absolute surprise of the night, Tiffany Stratton versus Trish Stratus. This was a wow. I was shocked at how good this match was. Trish Stratus, she far exceeded my expectations. She obviously hasn't been a full-time participant in quite some time. So if you want to compare her to the Goldberg comeback, she crushed it. This match was fast-paced, great action, great moves, good stuff, lots going on. And it seemed to me like Trish is working better now than she was 20 years ago. This was an awesome match. And then you see little clips and little pieces of Tiffany Stratton being a heel. And I think this is all going to lead to her being a bad guy, because I think that's better for her character. People are cheering for her now, but I think she's going to be a much better heel. But yeah, Trish, great freaking match. Surprise of the night. It was awesome. Then we had Naomi versus Jade with Bianca Belair as the special guest referee. This was a no holds barred match. This was a match on the card that I was actually most excited for. Honestly, it was all right. Pissed me off though. They had to do the Slim Jim table shot, the table spot. And I'm like, here we go again with the freaking Slim Jim table. What are we doing? Also side note, listen, I don't know how everyone else feels about this, but Maybelline is the main sponsor of Women's Evolution. How do we feel about that? I mean, look, I get it, but is this a little too much right on the nose? I mean, is there a chance that Maybelline's going to sponsor Raw or SmackDown or Clash in Paris or SummerSlam or Survivor Series? Or is it strictly because this is your all-female show that Maybelline now is jumping in and they're in the middle of the mat? You all know how I feel about the sponsorship nonsense. It is infuriating. And the fact that I can watch AEW and not see any of that crap in the ring, and now I'm watching, they did it with Saturday Night's Main Event with the new Naked Gun movie is prominently displayed all over the ring. And then Sunday night we see Evolution sponsored by Maybelline, and we have Riyadh Season on the mat. And I'm like, what the hell are we doing? But I don't know how you all feel about that. I just felt like, really? We're going to have Maybelline be the sponsor? I don't know. Maybe I need a female perspective on that. I'm not sure how I'm supposed to feel, but I thought it was freaking stupid. Anyway, this match was okay, and the finish was kind of telegraphed for about 5 minutes. She hit the Jaded off the top rope through the table. The one spot I did like, at some point, Jade grabs the cameraman's camera and uses it to hit Naomi and then kind of chucks it over the top of the ring, over the ropes. I thought that was a cool spot. But yeah, I was a little underwhelmed. I thought that this was going to be better. And again, goes back to the point I made a little while ago where it's like, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with Jade. I don't know. I'm hoping they could figure it out, because I want her to be good. Then we have the 20 women battle royal. The winner gets a title shot at Clash in Paris. Again, it's like the gauntlet match with the men at All In. You know, because of the stipulation, there's literally only 3 to 4 wrestlers who could win this. So, and the problem with the battle royal match is there's 20 people in the ring, and it takes 2/3 of the match to get most of these scrubs out of there. So the last 5 minutes were really good. You're left with Chelsea Green, Nia Jax, Lash Legend, who, shout out to her, she looked great in this match. You had Nikki Bella and Stephanie Vaquer. So pretty good final five. And then it comes down to Lash versus Stephanie Vaquer. And she manages to hit the devil's kiss on the ring apron. It was pretty crazy. The crowd's going nuts. Look, Stephanie is a freaking star in the making. They are putting a rocket ship on her and shooting her straight to the moon. She is great. She's great. So she does the devil's kiss. Lash falls to the ground, and Vaquer is your winner. She's going to go on to Clash in Paris, whatever the hell it's called, and we shall see who she challenges. But pretty good ending to the match. The first, like I said, 2/3 of it, it's fine. It's whatever. There is one spot where Natalia does the worm, and I hope we never have to see that again. That was terrible, but hopefully that's a one-off because I don't need to see that again. And then finally, your main event, Io Sky versus Rhea Ripley for the Women's World Championship. I don't know. Two words. This is just awesome. Just awesome. These two could fight literally every night. They are fan-freaking-tastic. I think these two, their styles, the way they wrestle each other, they bring out the absolute best in each other, and they complement each other so well, which is crazy because Rhea is a foot taller, if not more, and their styles are just so vastly different. But they duke it out for 25 minutes or so, and it's awesome, great wrestling. So many great spots. I cannot recommend this match enough. It was fantastic. And so at some point, the ref goes down. They decide to take the match outside the ring. They're wrestling all around the arena. There's a spot where Io jumps off some sound or some stage equipment and does like a splash on Rhea. It's a really cool spot. They work back into the ring. They're fighting in the corner. Io hits a moonsault. You think the match is over. Rhea kicks out. They're both down. And then you hear Naomi's music. She comes down with a busted nose. It looks like she's carrying the caution taped wrapped briefcase, and she cashes in right then and there. She smashes Io with the briefcase. Then she throws Rhea out of the ring. She hits the split legged moonsault on Io, and 1, 2, 3, you have a new women's world champion, Naomi. It was awesome. I was watching this with such a smile on my face because a lot of people were complaining that the match shouldn't have ended like this, but it was perfect. It was perfect. I was so happy to see her win. The match was awesome, and this was great because everyone's thinking that Naomi's going to cash in on Tiffany Stratton at SummerSlam or whatever the case may be, cash in against Jade after she fights Stratton, something like that. This was perfect. It gets them separated, and Naomi now is on Monday Night Raw, and she has a whole new group of women that she can go up against. I think it's brilliant. It's brilliant. That match was awesome. And it was such a great ending to an awesome, awesome show. So my top five matches of the weekend, there's a tie at the top. It's between the Io Sky Rhea match and Toni Storm versus Mercedes. The women kicked so much ass. It was awesome. They destroyed it. So my hat's off to all the ladies. Y'all crushed it. Coming in at third, the Young Bucks versus Swerve and Ospreay. That match was great. And then right after that, it's the triple threat match to kick off Evolution. Your Lyra versus The Man versus Bayley. Awesome, awesome match. And then my fifth match of the weekend. Like I said, this match wasn't for everybody, but because there was so much at stake, because there was a schmoz of kind of chaos and craziness, and it was something you don't see every day, I'm going to go with Paige versus Mox, with Hangman being your new AEW champion. Great weekend of wrestling. I know this podcast has gone long, but I felt like I needed to talk about it all. And here we are. I'm recording this on Monday, and we're going to get ready to roll right into Monday Night Rollins without Rollins and see where we go from here. So yeah, this train doesn't stop. It was a great, great weekend of wrestling. Like I said, there was something for everybody, and hopefully you all found something that you liked and enjoyed. But that's going to wrap up this episode of the 3Ts podcast. If you have enjoyed this episode or any episode of this podcast, please do me a favor. Share it with someone you know, whether they are a Bills Mafia member, a card collector, or someone who just loves the freaking squared circle and is a huge wrestling mark. It doesn't matter. I'm trying to grow this one episode at a time. I can't thank you enough for sticking with me and listening. Hit that follow button. Leave a quick review wherever you podcast. Help me build this thing together. I appreciate you all very, very much. So until next time, whether it's ripping packs, breaking tables, or dropping elbows, keep doing what you love. And as always, go Bills!